we're moving on beyond the budget impasse. We want to talk about the next, 10 years, next, 20 years, next 50 years in Alaska.
Governor Bill Walker convenes a forum on the financial future of the state. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, June 5th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a federal restriction on the land designated for the UMed Access Road in Anchorage.
School purposes would be anything that supported the operation of the school on those lands.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Marine Conservation Council reminds Alaskans to choose local, sustainably caught seafood this summer. More information at akmarine.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The Federal Election Commission slapped Senator Dan Sullivan's campaign with a fine of nearly $3,000 for failing to disclose donations. The civil penalty stems from the so-called 48-hour notices candidates are required to file for donations received in the days before an election. The FEC found the Sullivan campaign received 4 contributions before the primary and 7 before the general election that weren't properly disclosed. The total amount of the donations in question comes to just over $25,000. Most, if not all of them, appear to be from out of state. The campaign, all told, raised almost $8 million. FEC documents say the fine was paid in April, before the commission put the case on the public record this week. Sullivan spokesman Mike Anderson says the FEC action follows the campaign's self-reported error. Weekend plans for about 175 diverse and influential Alaskans include discussing ideas for right-sizing state government, working with interactive financial models, and frank talk about the third rail of Alaska politics, revenue, taxes, and tapping the permanent fund. Governor Bill Walker and Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott are sponsoring the weekend retreat on building a sustainable future at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. They'll be sounding boards for big-picture policy discussions about the state's long-term fiscal future. KTOO's Jeremy Shea has more.
Governor Bill Walker says the location of the retreat has historical significance.
It'll be at the same site where the drafting of the Alaska Constitution took place in 1959. So I like going back to our roots, so to speak. I like it. It's at the university campus, and we're going to stay in the dorms. The vast majority of us will stay in the dorms at UAF.
Are you going to have a roommate? Are you sleeping in some undergrad's bed?
I think the first lady is going to be my roommate. I'm hoping she will be anyways.
Walker says he's looking forward to the collegiate atmosphere and dialogue. Many of the people invited to participate are members of his transition team that met after he was elected in November. While lawmakers are still at an impasse on the budget and how to address a multi-billion dollar deficit for the fiscal year that begins in July, that's not what this weekend is about.
We're moving on beyond the budget impasse. We want to talk about the next, 10 years, next, 20 years, next 50 years in Alaska.
We can't go around having our cake and eating it too.
Gunnar Knapp has studied the state's fiscal situation for months as director of the Institute of Social and Economic Research at the University of Alaska Anchorage. This weekend, he'll be speaking and listening.
It won't work anymore to say, I demand this, this, and this in terms of schools or ferry service or health or roads or troopers or whatever it is people want from the government, and at the same time saying, but I don't want anybody, using the permanent fund or asking me to pay taxes. You can't have it both ways.
The legislature's finance analysts have repeatedly noted this year that even if every state-funded government worker were laid off, the state would still spend billions more than what is forecast in revenue. Since January, Knapp says he's given at least 20 talks on the subject with various civic, education, and business groups. Progress has been slow.
You can't go way out in front of what people are willing to talk about, even if you're in the legislature and the governor and you know that eventually the conversation is going to have to get to those things. It is a process of education.
Knapp hopes that politically taboo fiscal matters will stop being taboo after this weekend.
I'm not going there to advocate any particular solution. I'm just advocating an open conversation about the nature of the problem.
The retreat itself is expected to be a frugal affair. Most of the participants are paying for their own travel, and dorms are a lot cheaper than hotels. There won't be bunk beds, but participants may have to share dorm rooms, says Claire Richardson, staff to the Lieutenant Governor. Richardson says she expects the state's final bill to be under $150,000. A big chunk of that is a $37,000 contract with, full disclosure, 360 North for web and television coverage. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
1960s-era regulations could impact the development of the UMed District Access Road, also known as the Burgaw Extension in Anchorage. The planned $20 million two-lane road would cut through University of Alaska Anchorage lands to join Burgaw with Elmore, but the land has restrictions on it dating from when it was sold by the federal government back in 1964. From the Urban Affairs Desk, KSKA's Ann Hillman explains.
The original land patent says the northeastern area of UAA land can be used for school purposes only. It allows for ditches and canals for mining and agriculture, and rights of ways for railroads and telegraphs, but not necessarily for roads. Dave Mishovic is the Bureau of Land Management's acting chief of lands and realty in Alaska. He cannot comment on the UMed District Road directly because the BLM hasn't received an official plan from UAA, which is the landowner. But he explains that federal land is sold at a discount to local governments and nonprofits under the Recreation and Public Purposes Act. But the land comes with restrictions. In order to use the land for anything else, landowners have to get permission from the Department of the Interior.
Well, yeah, they really need to, because if they don't and then we come back and find out they did something that they weren't allowed to, then we could start that reversionary action and take title back to the entire patent.
That means the federal government could take back the land. BLM spent months studying the land patent question this spring at the request of KSKA. They determined in the case of the UAA land, these rules apply to the area forever. But what does the restriction for school purposes only really mean, Mishovic?
School purposes would be anything that supported the operation of the school on those lands. So, for example, if they needed dormitories for students, you know, that would be in support of the school purpose. You know, their own roads and utility systems that support the school.
Mishovic says the landowner can also sell or give away portions of the land so long as the use of the land remains in the public interest. The Department of Transportation is developing the UMed Access Road. DOT spokesperson Shannon McCarthy says they don't think the patents would prohibit the development of the road or walkways.
Yeah, access to University of Alaska lands would fit into the purpose to provide access into the property itself.
A statement from UAA says they believe the UMed Road will provide additional access points to the campus and help the advancement of the university. But Carolyn Ramsey with Citizens for Responsible Development UMed says the purpose of the road is to relieve traffic congestion and does not meet the for school purposes only condition.
As far as their land, yes, it does give access to it, but there's a little word there that says only. And the school purposes only is specifically for education and school, not for traffic, for better access, for anything like that.
BLM Anchorage Field Manager Alan Bittner says they plan to look into the matter. The process won't take public comments into account, and it's unclear how long it will take because BLM hasn't seen the plans yet. DOT wants to start construction on the road this year. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
The Pebble Limited Partnership's lawsuit against the EPA alleging violations of the Federal Advisory Committee Act will go forward. That's according to a ruling yesterday by federal court judge H. Russell Holland. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
Holland denied the EPA's motion to dismiss the case, which was argued for last week in Anchorage court. Mike Heatwell is a spokesperson for Pebble Limited Partnership.
Well, the judge has essentially said that Pebble has raised plausible claims about how the EPA has handled and utilized input from anti-mining groups in all of the work regarding the Bristol Bay watershed assessment, And it represents a pretty significant victory for us that allows our case to advance.
Pebble's opponents were quick to say that they were disappointed with Thursday's ruling. Among them is United Tribes of Bristol Bay Director Alana Hurley, who acknowledged the setback but says it's important to keep perspective.
This case is about a federal advisory process protocol. It in no way changes the scientific fact that if the Pebble mine is developed, it will harm the Alaska salmon fishery on the face of the planet. It doesn't change the fact that the EPA has this authority to take this action to protect our fishery and has had and will continue to have the full support of our region to do so.
While the FACA case moves forward, the judge has ordered the EPA to do no work on the Bristol Bay watershed assessment or the dredge and fill restrictions the agency had intended to finalize earlier this year. Judge Holland's temporary injunction requested by Pebble will remain in place, according to Heatwall.
Which basically prevents the EPA from advancing its preemptive veto against the project. And the next phase for us is to seek discovery. And I think as we've long asserted, we believe there's quite a bit more information out there as to what was going on behind the scenes with the EPA's actions against Pebble.
There's no timeline for the FACA case, though both sides said it was likely to go on for at least a year. In a separate but related lawsuit, the third filed by Pebble against EPA, Pebble is suing the agency for more documents and emails. Pebble says EPA has been slow to respond to its requests under the Freedom of Information Act. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Still to come on Alaskan News Nightly, harvesting tundra plants for aches, pains, and other ailments.
So we're infusing chaga. We haven't used this yet, and it's just infusing. Look at the beautiful black color of the oil.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
A Wasilla man is dead after an accident in Wrangell-St. Elias National Park. According to park officials, 62-year-old Clark J. Baldwin was killed when he backed into a spinning plane propeller. Peter Christian is the district ranger.
So what we know with the early reports of the investigation are is that there were four Super Cub airplanes at the Peavine Strip within the park, and all four of them were running. The engines were running. And Mr. Baldwin was outside of his own aircraft attempting to help one of the other airplanes when he accidentally backed up into his own prop and was killed instantly.
The accident happened around 11 a.m. yesterday. Christian says it was 2 p.m. before park rangers were able to get to the site. The Peavine Bar Strip is about 15 miles east of McCarthy. Christian says Baldwin was the owner of Alaska Cub Training Specialists, a flying club based in Wasilla. He was a retired lieutenant colonel in the Air Force. The advisory panel to the North Pacific Fishery Management Council has come out in favor of reducing halibut bycatch in the Bering Sea. The panel is made up of fishing industry representatives, and it was tasked with making a formal recommendation on the issue, by far the most contentious of the Sitka meetings happening right now. After a day and a half of emotional testimony from all sides, the panel voted 11 to 10 to reduce the bycatch cap for the Bering Sea groundfish fleet by 31% overall. Since the fleet is already under its cap, that would amount to a real reduction of about 13% from the five-year average. The issue now goes before the council itself. King salmon are beginning to show up on the Kuskokwim River. All eyes are on the few kings that are appearing in the Bethel test fishery and in subsistence fishermen's nets during limited openings. At a Wednesday work session of the Kuskokwim River Salmon Management Working Group, members prepared for more restrictions. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
The river is restricted to a weekend set net fishing schedule with small mesh nets for whitefish. Federal staff recently counted 72 set nets between the Johnson River and Tulik-Sack. Because those nets can catch thousands of king salmon incidentally, Federal in-season manager Neil Lalonde says they're tracking the early season fishing closely.
There will be additional officers on the river starting this Saturday. They are talking to a lot of people along the river. There have been a few warnings that have been written. We have seized a few nets. There was an 8.5-inch net that was seized. And however, for the most part, we are getting good compliance with the 4-inch opportunity.
Lawan spoke at a recent meeting of the Kuskokwim River Salmon Management Working Group at the Alaska Department of Fish and Game Office in Bethel. The working group, which meets weekly during the summer, is an advisory group made up of stakeholders from up and down the river. Another below-average king salmon run is forecast, and federal managers are aiming for the upper end of the river's escapement goal to ensure the long-term health of the fishery. There will, however, be a directed king salmon fishing opportunity through a community permit system that begins in a week. Managers expect a total harvest of about 15,000 king salmon this summer, 8,000 incidentally in nets, and 7,000 through the permit system. A few people from the Middle River expressed concern about the possible level of harvest. Working group member Dave Cannon spoke by phone from Aniak.
Up here in the Middle River and probably Upper River, we just flashed back to 2013, where it looked like things were okay and everybody was doing fine. But when it came down to it, the Upper River folks got the short end of the stick.
That year started with liberal early season fishing and ultimately brought in the lowest escapement in history. Restrictions came later in the summer when more fish had not arrived after the slow start. The river this year is split between federal management below Aniak and state management above Aniak during the King Salmon Run. As the season intensifies, Working Group Chair Bev Hoffman expressed cautious optimism.
I just feel we're on a better track than past years. Am I still worried? And, yes, and that's why I feel like this conservation mode is important.
She says the Kuskokwim kings, which have been in decline, need to make it upriver to spawning grounds if there are to be fish in the future. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
Today is National Donut Day, and one Anchorage shop is getting national attention. The Kobuk's old-fashioned donuts were highlighted by Huffington Post as one of the best in the country. Donut baker Mike Bonito is trained as a professional cook and baker. He says anyone can make a roast, but a donut is different.
Donuts have lots and lots of little variables that you have to be able to control and to master. And once you get it all figured out, your donut is different than other donuts. It's a reality.
He lovingly explains that to get the perfect donut, you have to mind the temperature of the oil, the batter, and even the room.
Okay, here's how picky these donuts are. This fryer has a heating element, but it doesn't heat at the same temperature all throughout. So as try as I might, I rotate the donut from the front to the back while they are actually frying. But every once in a while, I miss one. And when you miss one for just, 10 or 15 seconds at a different part of the fryer, it affects it.
Bonito started baking nearly 40 years ago. 20 of those years have been focused almost exclusively on donuts.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Elizabeth Jenkins. This week on AK, tundra healing. Right now, the tundra and forest of Bristol Bay are exploding with flora. While many foragers have already munched on fiddlehead ferns and are looking forward to wild berry picking, they may overlook the traditional medicinal uses of many Alaskan plants. Two Dillingham women set out to capture the benefits of these native plants in a line of homemade bath products they call Tundra Love. KDLG's Hannah Colton has the story.
It's a bright spring afternoon, and the ground floor of Lynn Van Vactor's home smells of shea butter and citrus. With hot plates, a weigh scale, and bottles of oils on the shelves, the space feels like part chemistry lab, part art studio. Van Vactor and her business partner Denise Lisick hand me a mason jar. It's filled with a dark, oily mixture.
And that's chaga. So we're infusing chaga. We haven't used this yet, and it's just infusing. Look at the beautiful black color of the oil.
Other jars are lined up against the sunny window. They're filled with infusions of rose hips, carrot, and cottonwood buds. Van Vactor explains this is an early step in the long process of making a soap or salve.
Let it sit for at least 6 weeks in the sun. And every day you turn and toss those oils so that they stir inside that jar. Yeah, so that's some chaithuk.
This basement operation got its start last fall when Van Vactor and Lisick both signed up for a class taught by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium on native plants.
The store outside your door, basically. So Denise and I sat next to each other.
Yeah, that's how it started.
That's how it started.
The training taught about plants that elders in Bristol Bay have used medicinally for generations. These healing plants are all over the place. Plantain is a natural antibacterial. Rose hips are high in vitamin A for healthy skin.
And the birch bark, the salicylic properties that can treat some of those conditions of inflammation and the soreness. And
Van Vactor and Lisick shared a fascination with these plants. And when they decided to do something about it, they found they each brought a useful skill set to the table.
I started out in nursing and psych and pre-med. So I always had an affinity for naturopathic medicine. And Denise has this expert gardening knowledge of plants.
So they had a pretty good foundation. But, she says, they still have a lot to learn on the healing side of things.
The native healers that use these products will spend a year just studying one plant to really understand the therapeutic benefits of those plants. So we're no way in that category, but we've had enough knowledge and ability to utilize the products in a way that's effective for things that we'd actually want in our day-to-day life.
So with a lot of research and some digging in the dirt, they started making soaps, salves, and bath bombs. Each recipe includes local plants for a specific purpose. And the products have upbeat names like Pick Me Up, Restore My Skin, and Aches Away. Both Lisick and Van Vactor are semi-retired from long careers, so they're not expecting to make a living off Tundra Love. But with a price point of $10 for 2 ounces of salve or balm, they say they were already able to earn back their initial investment. Their first big sale at Christmas time sold out. Since then, they've gotten rave reviews. Friends and family are asking them to make more.
You know, I know of a person whose feet had been in pain for months and months, and those salves have helped alleviate the pressure in their feet, and they're able to walk better. And so there's like little testimonials coming up.
Encouraged by these happy customers, Van Vactor and Lisick are dreaming up new products. They're watching for summer plants to come up so they can infuse another batch of oils. One of the biggest lessons learned, Van Vactor says, is that the recipes go based on what Mother Nature provides. For example, they're itching to try out a naturally bug-repellent oil made from wild yarrow, but
it's going to be at least a couple months for the yarrow. And it really goes gangbusters in the fall. You'll get little sprouts of it coming up between now and then, but mm-hmm.
You'll pull it out of your garden.
Yeah.
And now when we pull it out of our gardens, we will set it aside and
we're going to use it.
While their first priority is to make enough for local customers, Lisick and Van Vactor eventually want to expand. They imagine a network of Tundra Love producers, bringing healing plants into homes all over Bristol Bay. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. Sheila Arkell and her husband moved to Anchorage from Washington, D.C. in the 1980s. She says the city felt a lot more isolated in those days.
So the only way to keep in touch with your family was through standard old mail, snail mail, writing letters, and making phone calls, which were expensive to make long distance phone calls. So you always had a sense of isolation, and that bothered me at first. But the community was what was unusual. I thought, coming from the East Coast, where life was very competitive. You live in a big power city like Washington, D.C. You're at these academic institutions, and everything's about what kind of job you have and what kind of money you make and the power you have, people you know. It wasn't like that here. People were more open to meeting other people, new ideas. Everybody had this sense of connection and a sense that we're all in this together, and that we don't give a damn how they do it on the outside. And I liked meeting so many people from different backgrounds, people of different education levels and different economic strata. Everybody mingled together, and they were willing to work together. I remember meeting a lot of people who were here to start over, to get away from something, and it just struck me that I had never thought before about needing a place of refuge or having a broken past or something that you needed to come away from. You know, people came here for many, many reasons, but there were some people who came here just to start over. And because it was so isolated, you could actually get away from your past up here pretty well. I mean, nobody could track you down. I mean, there wasn't Facebook, you know. You had more of a chance to be isolated from your past if you needed to, and a chance to renew yourself.
Sheila Arkel lives in Eagle River. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. If you want to tell your story, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Hannah Colton, Zachariah Hughes, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Jeremy Shea in Juneau, Ann Hillman and Ellen Lockyer at Anchorage, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Rachel Waldholtz in Sitka, and Ben Matheson in Bethel. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the promised tuition grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.